Hi, I'm Reagan, and thanks for listening to my dad's podcast, Lasting Learning.
Welcome to Lasting Learning, the podcast that was started because I thought I had things to say. The podcast that continues to grow because we've learned that your stories matter more. Welcome to Lasting Learning, where we explore great people doing extraordinary things, sharing with us the lasting lessons they've learned along the way. Thanks again for checking out this episode. Just a reminder, as you listen to this episode, one of the goals behind the Lasting Learning podcast is to amplify diverse voices. The goal is never to say, this is the way to think. This is the answer to your problem. It's simply an opportunity to engage in critical thought, to start the conversations. So as you listen to this episode, know that my goal is not to say, this is the way to think. Some of what you hear today, you might disagree with. Some of what you hear today, you might agree with. Regardless, use this as an opportunity to engage in the conversation. Use this as an opportunity to continue to propel yourself forward. So without any further ado, this week's episode here on Lasting Learning. All right, everybody, welcome back to another episode of the Lasting Learning Podcast. Now, those of you that listen to this show on a regular basis know that my aim, my goal with this show is to introduce you to amazing people that are doing incredible things, that teach us lessons that can truly last our lifetimes. And today is no exception. However, I also want to give you a heads up that today's conversation is going to be a little bit different. Today, we're having a conversation that's kind of real. It's kind of somber. And for some of you, it might even be a little triggering. I've got an amazing guest on who's got an incredible resume. He's done a lot of amazing things in his life, and we'll talk through all of that. We'll help build that expertise level so you understand who the guy is that's on the other end here. But what we're going to be talking about ultimately deals with student safety and school safety. We're going to be talking about school shootings. We're going to be talking about how to keep people safe. We're going to be having possibly some differences of opinions. Some of you might have practices and protocols in your own schools right now, and some of what you might hear might be counter to that. We're starting the conversation. We're going to open up the conversation so that you can continue with the conversation. That being said, I want to make sure that I am able to introduce my guest, and thank God for LinkedIn that has this amazing name pronunciation guide on it, because I was able to go and listen to this thing on repeat this afternoon. I used to think I had a hard name to pronounce. I can't even say it right now. Dave Schmitto, right? A lot of people have butchered that. I can only imagine how many people have butchered your name. So without any further ado, I bring to you today, Daniel Deluzneski. How was that? Was that pretty good?
Perfect, Dave. Perfect.
All right. Daniel Deluzneski, thanks for being here today. I mentioned that you've got quite the resume. You've spent time working in the Secret Service. You spent time working emergency management. You've spent time working with school systems and helping design safety protocols. You've really done it all. But I want you to be able to sell yourself real quick and introduce yourself to the people that might be listening all across North America, really all around the world. Let them know who you are and what brings you to this point in your life.
Well, I had to get what you call an elevator pitch, but it's been a long journey. And it's been, I think, an important one for me. I'm passionate about the subject. I do have a 17-year-old who's in high school. He's a senior now. Hopefully, we'll go on to college. He's starting to work towards that way. But when this started, I started with the county system here back in, 2014. And, you know, at that time was 5 years ago. So he was still in middle school and then high school. So, yeah, it just... Let's go back a little bit. We can start with the Secret Service. I was 24 years in the Secret Service. I went to school out in Southern Illinois, and for whatever reason, I switched over to criminal justice. When I first started out, I wanted to be in broadcasting. I wanted to be a sports broadcaster. That was my main goal of going to college and all that kind of stuff. And that kind of got
you and me both. That's what I went to college for as well.
It was very cliquish. And it was who you know, not what you know. So I switched over to criminal justice. That was going to be my minor anyways, and finished with that and came back. And like I said, I grew up in Connecticut, And I was going to get a job over there in law enforcement. And I tried a few agencies, the state police, this one, that one, and then things just didn't work out. And at the time, you know, when you're a kid, you know, and I'm not saying this broadly because I have been in law enforcement. You're thinking as a kid, you know, most police are jerks. You know, all they do is pull you over and they're telling you what to do and point you this and do that and do this. And, you know, and as you're a kid, you don't want authority anyway. So I don't know if this is such a good career move here. So I knocked around a few jobs, and to make a long story short, I joined the service in 88. I started at the end of Reagan's term and finished up in Obama's term. And I didn't even know, because this was before internet. I had no idea. I thought it was the guys that talk in their sleeve. They wear the suits and they talk in their sleeve and they wear the sunglasses and they're with the president all the time. No idea that there was a separate division. There was a separate uniform division. And they were created years ago, back in the 20s, a combination of Metropolitan and Park Police. And they became the Executive Protective Service there at the White House. And it, you know, that evolved, obviously, and became part of the Secret Service. And they were the specialized units. They had canine. They had the motorcycles. They had the counter snipers. They had the SWAT teams. They had all the neat stuff that you wanted to do. Oh, I said, I want to be with them. And the nice thing about it was you got to stay in D.C. I didn't get to be transferred all over the darn place. I got to stay right there. So when I joined up, I joined up at a later age. I was about 10 years older than the rest of my class. However, it's just circumstances. It's, you know, I tell people, and I even tell my son, look, a lot of times it's about luck and timing. And it just, I came in and my supervisors were my age. And I got these opportunities that I wouldn't have gotten, I think, if I had joined when I was much younger. So it worked out. And I got into K-9. I was the youngest in years grade as an officer to get into K-9. And my dog was just this. Okay, well, we don't have to go that too much into the dog thing, but he was a red dog. They're Belgian Malinois. And a lot of police agencies use them now. And anybody out there that's got a Belgian Malinois, I know they're just this crazy, neurotic, hypersensitive, very, very intelligent dog.
It's the dog that, so as we're recording this, the fugitive in Pennsylvania just got caught, right? The guy that escaped from jail. That's the kind of dog that was used to capture him. I just saw that this morning. So it looks like a German Shepherd, but it's intense and fast. Yeah.
Yeah. They call them red dogs or land sharks. They're very intense. Anyway, it was at the time, the longest training of anything in the Secret Service, longer even than the counter snipers, because at that time, it was dual trained. My dog was both bomb trained and what they call handler protection or, you know, bite training. So that's why it took so long, because they go through this dual training and they want to make sure you can get that dog off the bite before you bring them home. And they wanted that. The Secret Service, their belief was, unlike the military, they want that dog with you, that bond, not put him out in a kennel and go get him, you know, on duty. No, they want you with that dog 24 hours a day. And it worked out. Anyways, it worked out for a little while. He didn't work out completely, but I got to keep him. He lived till he was 13 years old. A great dog. Wow. Anyways, I still miss him. So I was there for 24 years, left that, was going to go down to Florida, live on a beach, have a beer. I'm done. And as you know, an alpha personality like myself or in law enforcement or anyone else who's got alpha personality, that lasts a few months and you drive yourself crazy. And my ex-wife, my wife at the time, said, look, you got to do something. You can't be sitting around doing nothing. And she was right. And I found this job with the county that was perfect for my resume. And I joined up with them. And again, this was back, I say, 2014. So the protocols in place, coming from the Secret Service, you know, I'm in protection. So I know what I'm doing in that end. So that was the whole mindset, protect the kids, protect the staff. What are they doing? Well, we're going to start from the outside. So most of these schools still had either no fencing or like 3 feet fencing. Like,
okay. I'm going to pause you real quick because I want to make sure that people can track where we're going. So you moved to Florida, uh-huh, and you took on this job. And when you say you worked for the county, what some people don't understand that might not necessarily live in Florida is Florida has countywide school systems. So right, when you say you're working for the county, you're not necessarily working civil service, working for the mayor or for the county commission. You're working for the school system. And it was correct. Pinellas County, which is one of the biggest school systems in America, one of the biggest in Florida with 120, 130 schools. I mean, it's huge.
Yeah, it was 140 schools. I dealt with over 100,000 students and a very dense county. And again, I kind of, you know, and when you're thrown into this, you're really not sure what you're dealing with, because, you know, your mindset when I moved to Florida was that's where old people go. I mean, there are a lot of families with children down here and a lot of kids in these school systems. But yeah, Pinellas County school system, I work for the county system, but it was just me. You know, again, I didn't know anything about what was going on in these schools.
What was your responsibility when you got that job?
My title was coordinator of emergency management for the Pinellas County school system. Just me. I had no staff. There were no deputies, or it was just me. And I had a staff of people that dealt with the maintenance part of it. They worked with me if I needed a fence, if I needed a door lock, something like that. But otherwise, I'm on my own. So I'm not a desk person. So I was like, I got to go out and see what the heck's going on here. So I made sure I visited every 140 schools and every principal of those schools. It took me over a year, but I was determined to do that because I had to find out some kind of, you have to realize back then, Dave, there were no safety audits. There was no one that came around to these schools and said, hey, you need a camera here, or hey, you need to cut those bushes back there. There was nothing like that.
Is that what the job posting was? I just want to make sure that people can track with this history. So you said there was this perfect job that fit with your resume, and it was called coordinator of emergency management. Was it somebody that was supposed to be, you weren't asked to have a canine with you, but you were asked to make sure that the schools were safe? Yes. Okay. So you were the primary gatekeeper, if you will,
correct,
to the schools.
Yes, civilian position. It was not a law enforcement, it was a civilian position. Now, the nice thing was, and again, this was, again, something I didn't know about, we had what were called schools police. They had police powers, but that was their designated position to be in the school. They weren't, again, we didn't get to that part yet till when I left, by the time we got school resource officers, but we had a schools police agency that I worked in coordination with if something did happen to these schools. And again, they didn't have police inside the schools. This was something they would respond to an issue that would happen to school. They had canine that would go in if they were needed for whether it was, you know, a gun in the school or drugs or whatever. But I worked hand in hand with those and also with the guys that did all the maintenance and stuff with the schools.
So you were the proactive arm, if you will, where you were responsible for helping identify the vulnerable spots, the vulnerable positions, and help hopefully coordinate with maintenance, custodial staff, to come in and take care of those things, and then also coordinate with these school officers so that they understood your recommendations. Is that fairly accurate? Okay.
Yeah. And the other thing is, we're starting from ground zero. These schools, you would ask them, well, do you have a safety plan? Well, yeah, it's over here.
The binder on a shelf. Yeah.
Right. It's just sitting there. Well, when was it updated? I don't know. It's collecting dust. I mean, there was no, the state didn't do anything about this. The county really didn't care about this. There weren't anything that was required for them to do. The only times this would come up, usually, if there was an incident, then the press would ask, well, do you guys have some kind of protocol with this? Yes, we follow the protocol and the safety plan I have right over here. But it was really outdated. So, and the only other thing that bothered me was I didn't have autonomy. There wasn't something I could go in and say, you need to do this. Because like everything else, as you know, in the school system, there's hierarchy. I had a boss who then had a superintendent, who then had a school board. It wasn't something, and even that, which was a frustrating part of it, but I did learn to work within the system because the bureaucracy is kind of the same, whether it's federal government or state or county government. However, at the time, actually through the whole 4 years I was there, I did have a boss that backed me on something, unless, we can get to the unless part, but there were times that if there was something I needed to be done because it was so, just common sense and just so, you know, outrageous that it needed to be done. And one of the first things was codes. I would go in and ask them, what do you say when you have a lockdown? Well, we say code red. Okay. What would that mean to the maintenance worker that showed up today, or the parent visiting, or someone from out of town, or a substitute? What would that mean? Well, they should all know what means code red means you're locking down. I said, well, you're making that assumption. Why not just use plain language? Oh, no, we've used codes for years. That took forever. That took over a year for me to get them out of these stinking codes because it made no sense to me. I said, you use plain language. always use plain language. It's no big deal. Now, I did have a story. I mean, we could talk about the book, but I had an elementary school, kind of off the beaten path. And I went there and talked to them, and I talked to the principals, and I said, what are you guys using, you know, when you go into the lockdown? Well, the term we use is, this is elementary school. The term we're using is the pony's being delivered today. And I kind of laughed. I said, what? Yeah, that's what we use so we don't scare the kids. And I said, well, wait a minute. You're going to have some people here to go, there's a pony being delivered today. Oh my gosh, I got to go see this. I said, no. I said, you can't, don't do that. I said, it's okay. These kids are not that naive that just use plain language. I said, the teachers, no, they're going to train. They're going to tell these kids, you know, hey, we're hiding from the bad guy, whatever games they use to help these kids. I always love working in elementary schools because, number one, and you're probably the same way, these kids listen. They listen to you. I mean, they're like sponges. They pick up on all this stuff. Once you get to middle and high school, it's like, whoa, okay, you know, now the hormones are kicking in. But I always love working with elementary school kids because they're not naive. I had one school, and I'm sorry, I'm jumping around, but I had one school, it's a two-tiered school. And when you walked up from the outside, because it was an open school, you walked from the outside in through a set of double doors. And then there was five classrooms in the round inside these two glass double doors. And I asked the teacher in the first classroom, I said, who's in charge of locking these outside doors? Well, I am, because the key is over here in the fire extinguisher panel. I said, okay, if you're not here, then what happens? What's plan B? Well, then Mrs. So-and-so is supposed to do it. I said, okay, is there a plan C if you got substitutes here? Yes, there's supposed to be blah, blah, blah. Okay. So as I'm talking to her, this is a fifth grade class. One of these little kids goes, I know where the key is. I know where the key is. I said, okay, does everybody here know where the key is? Yeah, it's out there by the fireworks. And I said, let's go. I brought all those kids out of that class and had them take that key out and go over and lock that door. And you see these kids' faces just beaming with this accomplishment. I said, you guys are heroes. I said, because if your teacher passes out or gets injured or can't get to that fire extinguisher, it's okay. Go out there. If you hear that there's a lockdown and you lock that door and you guys are heroes and these kids are beaming. And anytime I ran a lockdown drill at these elementary schools, not only were we lucky because we had door locks that worked. You didn't have to use a key. And inside most of the classroom in elementary school, you have the bathroom. So I would go in at the end of the lockdown, which we can go through the procedure of that.
Yeah, I've got a few questions here in just a second. So I'll let you finish up with this one, though. With this story.
At the end of the lockdown, you go and unlock the door with a key, and we'd walk in, and where are the kids? She would take these 25 kids and stuff them into the bathroom, right? I said, great, now you got double coverage. And we'd open the bathroom door up, and they would come out with smiles on their face. They said, all you guys get a gold star today. I mean, these kids would just do a great job. And it was just an amazing thing to work with elementary schools. Not that it wasn't bad at middle or high schools, but because there are more elementary schools in the system, it's just the way it is, sure, than you have middle and high school as you go up in grade. But anyways, that was just an example of dealing with these kids and with lockdowns and stuff. And using plan.
Yeah. So your history is fascinating to me, right? You're in the Secret Service, you're responsible for helping protect one of the most vulnerable spots in America, let alone the world, a place where tourists are constantly traveling, where there are VIPs constantly there. So you have to maintain this sense of accessibility, that we are open, we're welcoming, but yet we are also protected and we are safe and we are secure. You provide this invisible fence along with a physical fence to try to make sure that people are safe and protected. And you transform schools now in a very similar way. When you move to Pinellas, you're going into these schools and you're saying these schools are vulnerable, number one, because of maintenance and structural components. But now you're also examining that they might be vulnerable because of people issues, right? You're not from the world of education. You're from the world of law enforcement, and you insert yourself into an educational environment. And I'm imagining that at times, you got pushback from people who said, okay, but you don't understand. These are kids we're dealing with. We have to have these ponies being delivered and these crazy codes, because if not, chaos will ensue. Trust us, this is what's best for kids. Where at the same time, you're thinking, no, what's best for kids is keeping kids safe and alive. And it's same vision, same mission, but two completely different approaches and strategies. Is that fairly accurate so far?
That is very accurate. Because of it being an education, you know, it's oil and water. Law enforcement and education, it's oil and water. They will push back because, like you said, you don't understand. This is the way things have to be run. I deal with these children all day. You know, this is the way it's supposed to be run. So I get it.
Yeah.
And after going through it, through these drills, and the nice thing was I got to go to a lot of meetings at, you know, the before school meetings they'd have with teachers. And, you know, after, well, this was, you know, obviously after Columbine, but after the shootings, we'd have Sandy Hook and then you had Parkland. These teachers are scared.
Yeah.
I mean, I would go to these meetings and every hand was up going, this is not what I signed up for. My husband, my boyfriend, my wife is saying, stop. This is scary.
Yeah.
And I would try to explain to them, look, the chances of this happening is one in a million, maybe more than that. It's like being struck by lightning. It's more than likely not going to happen. It's not. However, I want you to be prepared. I want you to have the confidence that if it does, I'm not training you to be some paramilitary soldier and flip a switch and you're all of a sudden going to become this other figure in your life. No, it's not going to happen. But I just want you to have the confidence. If we run enough drills and train just by implicit memory and muscle memory, it'll kick in. It's simple.
Yeah.
It's not complicated. A lockdown, basically, we all know it's the doors. Again, classroom doors should already be locked. I'm getting some pushback because, number one, some schools will say, well, we don't have locks on the doors. Well, that's an easy fix. That's not something that's really expensive. The other thing I can push back is, well, teachers will say, no, the kids are constantly coming out. It's a pain in the ass. They give them a pass and they got to go here and they got to go there and I got to go open the door for them. Tough. You've got one less step now if something happens to go over and lock that door. Your main thing now is turn off the lights, close the blinds. You sit on the floor quietly. You silence your phone. You do not listen to any announcements or anybody banging on that door or any alarms. Help is on the way. And it just over and over again, repeating that. And in fact, in the book, what I did was, because it's worked for me and it's worked for other places, I made up a little card that you can laminate that has just the quick stuff on it. So you can look at it because, Dave, you and I, look, I went through 9/11 and I had training, but something in a chaotic situation, you can forget your name. You can forget what day it is. And I'll tell stories of where I've had teachers freeze during an actual event. So it's something that I think it's quick reference. You put it on your lanyard where your ID is or whatever, and you quickly look at it and see, oh, did I forget something? Yes, I forgot this. I forgot whatever. So it's just something that's a quick reference in case something happens. It's just something that came to mind and it seemed to work out. But
it's brilliant. It's brilliant. You know, I began my teaching career right around the time of Columbine, right? So through the course of my educational professional career, I went through multiple iterations of quote unquote best practice. As people would come in and say, this is what you need to do. This is what you need to do. When I first began teaching, there was no such thing as a lockdown drill. Like that didn't exist. We had tornado drills and fire drills and that was it. Yep. And then we started experimenting with what would happen if a bad guy came in. And it was you go hide, you go find a bathroom somewhere, like you said, and you get as far away from walls and windows as you can. And then it turned into magical ponies are showing up or whatever. And then we started getting newer protocols. And the most recent protocol, the one that is getting all of the attention across America today, is this one called the Alice Protocol, which a lot of people take it to mean fight or flight, that you get away. And if you can't, you start fighting the bad guy. Through all of this, though, teachers are super compliant, right? We want to do what's right. We love our kids and we want to protect our kids, but we are also human beings. So we're trying to rationalize and we're trying to justify, am I good enough? Am I strong enough? Am I smart enough to make the decisions in the moment? So having that little thing on your lanyard, I think is brilliant. Just a quick little reference. We do it with educational materials all day long. We've got the cheat sheets. We've got the answer keys with us. So why not have the answer key with you on your lanyard? I think that's brilliant. But there are people listening right now, though, that I think might have some questions, right? So let me introduce a few things to you. When I was a building principal, I was one of those guys that you would have hated. because I was fighting for my teachers and I need to make sure that we have an open environment for all classrooms. And I would tell the teachers that when the district shows up or the fire marshal shows up, play the game and lock your door, but it's okay to leave your door open during the day or put one of those little magnet strips on the door so that it won't lock, because I want to make sure that you can come and go. You can go into each other's classrooms. Kids can come and go. And I said, if we have a warm, inviting environment, then bad things won't happen to us because everybody will be happy and singing kumbaya all day long and everybody will get along. And you're telling me that that's a wrong approach, that I should have gone to my teacher and said, just lock the doors. It's going to be sterile. You're going to stay in your room all day long. You're not going to be able to get in and out. You're going to be stuck here like a dungeon. You're saying that's okay. I know that's hyperbole, but you're saying that is something that we need to do. Just in that first step, lock your doors.
I like to have the doors locked during classroom sessions.
Okay.
This was something that I asked for years. It wasn't until just this past year that has started, the pendulum has started swinging that way, that the classroom doors stay locked. Yes, I agree with you. It should be an open atmosphere. You should have that kind of come and go as you please. To me, Dave, that's the old days. And when I say old days, I'm much older than you. Schools used to be open all the time.
Yeah.
You come in, yeah, play basketball, come in, walk through hallways, come in. I mean, they were open fields and stuff. And I understand it's gotten away from that. Is it sad? Heck yeah. I mean, take a good example, the White House. Freaking New Jersey barricades all over the damn place. This road is closed. Pennsylvania Avenue is shut down. So it shut down because it had to be. And that's what's happening with schools. I understand what you're saying, but this is something that I think it has to be done. And yes, you're going to get pushback from the teacher saying, this is a pain in the neck. I don't want to do this. But you know what? When we get to it, and I know we're going to get to it soon, this ALIS and options-based training, that's again something. Now, I'm going to give you an example, and you can give me the argument.
I'm going to pause you for a second, because that'll be our teaser. That I want people to understand ALIS and this, like, you're not a big believer in the ALIS approach. So I'm going to hold that for a second. Okay. I want to go back to where we are right now.
Okay.
Because number one, I agree with you. Doors should be locked. But I also know that in the back of my mind, I was one of those guys back then that would have fought against it. Similarly, I know that there are some people that have the mindset that what you just described is schools turning into like these prisons where you can't even get in the front door. I here in my city in Florida, there's not even a track I can go run on because there's tall 10-foot fences around every school. And in some cases, literally like barbed wire, like they are fortresses. They look like prisons. And there would be some people that would say, the more that we keep doing that, the more we keep hearing instances of school shootings. Back in the quote unquote good old days of the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, when schools were wide open, when they were community centers, we didn't have these issues. So maybe there's a connection there. Are you saying that that's not the case, that we need to continue to make schools more secure than we currently are? Or is the answer to make them wide open?
No, the answer is going to be they got to be more secure. And then the reason I say that is the data and statistics have already shown that your shooters are either former students or current students. And what are they doing? They're watching the school all the time. They know which door is going to be open. They know which door and gate are going to be open at a certain time. They know which door is going to be wedged open because the teacher stepped out for a smoke, or the kid's getting a pizza, or they're wedging it open for their buddies because they're late to class. They know all this stuff. So it to me, it's the opposite, that it becomes more secure. But there are a lot of safety security directors out there, and there are a couple experts and mentors of mine that the word now is holistic approach.
Mm-hmm.
The holistic approach is the entire thing we're talking about. Don't focus just on the lockdowns. We are going to focus on a layered effect to slow the shooter down when they do get in there, and we'll try to still make it welcoming. So as you know, when we start the school day, once we have all the doors closed, you will have one entrance they need to go to, one lobby that they will need to go into, and that lobby needs to be secure, which means they only have one way to go. They either go in because they have access and be buzzed in, or they go right back out that front entrance. So it's sad, yes, but we're never going to go back to the wide open, come on in and everybody's welcome approach. I wish it could get back to that, but I think even, you know, I'm a parent too. And, you know, you hate to see everything from when you go to the airport, to the courthouse, to the bank, to whatever it is, you see more and more layered security. Does it transfer to schools also? Yeah, it is. It's just the way society is today. And it's sad, but it's, I think, and this is not my lane, but I think it has something more to do with the mental health side, the pandemic, these ideas of the BLM movement, defund the police. I think that has created this atmosphere along with social media that's ruined what we've got going on with just the safety and security of our kids today, because we don't have to get that tightly into it. But I really think social media and the cyberbullying is just, again, that's not my lane, but it's just my opinion.
I'm gonna take that lane. I'm gonna let you know. I'm gonna have some other people on that represent some of those areas, so we can have those conversations. But I don't want that to distract people from the conversation we're having. Right? There's lots of reasons we can get into lots of reasons about the causation of this and what is, I almost used the word triggering this, but what is the impetus behind this? The reality is, it's happening in communities all over America. It's happening in inner cities. It's happening in suburbs. It's happening in urban areas. It's happening in rural areas. It's happening in elementary schools, middle schools, high schools, private schools, public schools, churches, malls, movie theaters. It's happening. And I have to continue to hold on to faith that people are continuing to look at all of these levels and all of these areas and having conversations like the one we're having right now, saying, what are some things that we can do? Recognizing that it's not single, it's multifaceted. There are multiple things. So the conversation we're having is not going to be the solution. It is a part of a solution to try to keep people safe. Knowing that these sorts of things could happen, we need to have a conversation of, if it happens, regardless of why, what do we do about it? And I hinted that you, with all of your expertise, your ability to go into hundreds of schools and represent hundreds of thousands of kids, you are not necessarily a fan of the latest protocol that is being presented across America. Mm-hmm. Here's the disclaimer for people. We don't represent your school. We don't represent your district. We are simply sharing perspectives here that will hopefully elicit more conversation so things can continue to evolve. So take that and know that. So for liability purposes, so that lawyers don't have to get involved or whatever, this is just an opinion that is being shared based off of your expertise, based off of your experience, based off of your data analysis. Talk to us a little bit. ALICE protocol, walk us through what that is and what is it that you disagree with?
ALICE protocol, I don't know the exact acronyms, but it's alert and locate and incident, evacuate, whatever the heck it is, because because I don't study it, because I don't believe in it. But I remember it was about a year before I had left the county system, and I had these principals come back, and they said, oh my gosh, we just went through ALICE training. This is so exciting. It's great for us. I think this is something we should do. I said, well, okay, what did they tell you have to do? Well, they told us that when a shooter comes into the school, to look at our cameras and then to go over the PA system and tell people where the shooter is going. And I'm like, what? Yeah. And they want us to run out of the building at a designated spot. And then if something happens where the shooter is going to break down the door, that we can fight him off. And I was so shocked. And I was like, what? So I had to go back and figure out what the heck is going on. I mean, this whole thing started back when Run, Hide, Fight was first created for corporate America. And there's a video out there. It was done by the Houston Police Department and Department of Homeland Security. It's at least 20 years old, maybe older than that. I mean, it's a good video. It shows a guy all dressed in black, and he's got a shotgun, and he's got a mask on. He comes into some office building, and the narrator in a very deep voice says, three things, you know, you have three options you're going to do. When a shooter comes in and starts shooting up the place, you can run away from the shooter and go to a designated spot outside the building. You can hide under your desk, hide in an office, whatever. Or if it comes to, you're going to need to fight. And then, you know, the big screen goes blank and they show these people getting ready with fire extinguishers in a chair and whatever the heck they are outside the door because they're going to fight because this person's going to come in. Okay. Somehow it got transferred over to schools. I don't know when this happened. I don't know why it happened. I heard a couple of FBI agents wrote a book and said this is a good idea. Some former law enforcement guy came up with the ALICE method. There are other people out there with different acronyms. One's called ALIVE, and one's called ALERT, and one's called something else. And I thought, okay, let's do this. Let's pretend we're a teacher. Let's just pretend we're a teacher. Doesn't matter, high school, elementary school, middle school. And the word goes out, we're in a lockdown, okay? Now, no one in their right mind has got the facilities nowadays to tell you where exactly the shooter is and where they're going. It's not possible. The technologies there cost too much. There's no school. Maybe schools have it. Maybe one in a million have it. There's no technology out there that's going to follow the shooter or have someone watching the shooter or where they're going. So now here you are, the teacher. Your door's already locked in your classroom. Now, they're telling you, you have the option to run out of the building or to stay in place. Okay. So if I'm a teacher, I'm thinking, number one, why am I putting under this pressure? Why do I have the stress of this option and this liability put on me to protect these 25 to 30 children? And they're giving me the option to run out of the building. And I'm going to take these children with me, go out into a hallway where they're going to hear the most horrific sounds they're ever going to hear. They're probably going to see things that they will never forget. More than likely, some of them are going to be injured, not by the shooter, but because they're going to run like maniacs to that exit. And guess what? It's not just my class. It's every other class in that hallway that's going to go out there and run to that same exit and pile up and funnel at that door and go out to where you think you're running away from the shooter. And I'll give you an example in Parkland. Parkland was an oddity because Parkland, the fire alarm went off. They were all set to either stay in the lockdown shelter in place or run. When the fire alarm went off, it changed everything. They had a drill just a month prior. When they interviewed two teachers afterwards, first they thought it's another drill. They were like, oh, must be another drill. It was not a drill. Then the fire alarm goes off, which they never trained for. So now they're like, wait a minute. We're told when the fire alarm goes off, we got to get out. So there was this chaotic confusion of, are we leaving? Are we staying? Some teachers came out into the hallway and thought, I hear where the gunshots are. We'll go in the opposite direction. What happened was they were hearing the echoes of the gunshots and they were going towards the shooter. So my argument is I'm not going to put that burden on a teacher to make that decision and suffer that liability if some of their students die, get injured, hurt, whatever, or suffer some kind of mental anguish afterwards when they have this horrific event, when you're perfectly safe in that classroom to lock down, the good guys are coming. And I'll give you an example.
I'm gonna pause real quick because I'm processing some of what you're saying and trying to predict where you're going to go with your conversation, okay? And I hope that the listeners right now are processing as well. And if you've got agreements, feel free to share them. If you've got disagreements, feel free to share them, right? This is the purpose is to increase the conversations, to increase the dialogue. But you said that you want to try to reduce the decision making from the people that aren't necessarily trained to make these sorts of decisions. Right. So with fire drills, we'll talk about that. In Parkland, I know there was a fire drill on top of an active shooter situation, but with fire drills, teachers are trained. When the alarm goes off, you leave. And yeah. For most teachers, there is a designated door that they have to go out, and it's kind of rote memory. But about 15 years ago, people started saying, okay, but what if there's a fire by that door? Do you have a plan B? And if you go there and there's a fire, do you know to turn? And we realized that very few teachers were able to train their students to make those sorts of decisions. And literally, they would say they had fake fire or people standing at a doorway saying, there's fire here, don't come through. There's fire here, don't come through. In a class, and the teachers would continue to walk right through it because they didn't have the ability to process, I need to find a different door. Okay.
Right.
Which is interesting, but it's because we've trained that rote memory of just go, just go, just go. So I'm going to take this with something you said early on about students are watching. A lot of what we're seeing, the data is telling us that it's current or former students that are watching behaviors and watching patterns, watching routines. When we have a situation, which we're getting to, where we start talking about active shooters, bad guys in a building wanting to hurt people, one of your goals is to make it so that teachers don't necessarily have to make these decisions that could be confusing and not just cause for litigation and liability, but more importantly, put themselves into situations where they might be making the wrong decision that could end up hurting them, harming them, killing themselves, killing kids. We want to try to keep as many people safe as possible, right? So one option in Alice is you can evacuate if that's what you choose. And you're saying starting at that level, you don't agree with that because that's a decision a teacher shouldn't have to make. No. If it's not a decision, if it's just leave and they don't have the option to stay, are you more comfortable with it now? So there's no more decision, you hear lockdown, teachers just get out of the building. Would you be in favor of that?
No.
Okay. Why?
Because it's just the reason I said. I mean, if you're going to have, and this is, we'll go back a little bit. A lot of times what I have teachers, when I give these podcasts, they'll come on and they'll answer questions. Look, I am told by the school board, by my principal, by my superintendent, this is the way we're going to run things. So as you said, teachers are like, look, it's my career. I don't have tenure. I got to follow what they're telling me to do. I wish I could follow your protocol, Dan, but we're not. We can't. What do we do? So it's, look, I said, yes, I get it. Either parents have to step up and go to the school board and say, how are we running these drills? You're not making my kids any safer. I mean, that's one thing that we can say, the arguments with the teachers. But look, I've gone in front of teachers for meetings. You know, normally, every start of every year, there'll be a three-day conference. 3 days, Dave, you probably have the same thing where you are. You know how much time I get to teach them anything about safety? 45 freaking minutes. That's all I get for 3 days, because the rest is all about edge of speak and the stuff that I don't understand, because like I said, it's oil and water. I don't understand what the heck's going on in education. So I try to give them as fast as I can for 45 minutes. This is what you need to do. I will come out and visit your school and see how you're doing. But right now, this is it. So with something like that, there is absolutely no way I would want a teacher, even myself, if I got put in that situation, to say, look, I don't have that type of training. I didn't sign up for this. Yes, just my door is already locked. I know what to do. We're going to sit on the floor and we're going to wait, because everything, and that's why my book is called 5 minutes, 3 to 5 minutes. Data shows at FBI, it's 3 to 5 minutes on average for an actual shooting. There is no recorded data that a shooter will shoot a locked door off. It takes too much time. It's happened once in like the last 20 years, and that was a targeted event. They're going to look for doors that are open, unlocked areas. Nashville's a perfect example. That shooter came in, lock, open, I'm going in. They're looking for easy victims, easy areas to get to, because they got a clock in their head going off too, because they know law enforcement is showing up. They're not going to shoot off a locked door. It just takes too long. So this idea that I'm going to go out of a perfectly safe classroom, bring these kids with me. And I tell you what, even elementary school kids nowadays, they're not stupid. My dad said, I can't go. I'm not going. I'm too scared. I don't want to do this. My dad's in law enforcement. He said, no, we stay in the classroom. So now you're going to have that argument when you're trying to get them out there in this chaotic situation. There's too much stuff happening for you to sit there and make that decision. And now, even during a drill, and I'll go back to where they're trying to follow this Alice method. During the drills, Dave, not real events. During the drills, there has been liability and legal action because kids are getting hurt just during the drills themselves. I'll give you two mentors of mine. One, and I don't think they would mind putting it out to your audience because they have websites. One is Michael Dorn. This guy's got 40 years of experience alone. His company is called Safe Havens International. They are worldwide known for their research and data when it comes to school emergencies, not just shootings, but emergencies. The other one's Ken Trump. It's now Dr. Ken Trump. No, he's no relation to the ex-president. He's also got 35, 40 years experience. And this guy is saying, look, you don't have enough time to teach kids to do all this, to teach teachers to do all this. You just don't have the time. why would you want to do that to bring them out? And I'm just talking about the run part. We're not even getting to the fight part because that is way off the scale. But just the run part, to go out there and expect you to be safe and you're going to a safe location because is there another shooter out there? I don't know. You're running into a situation you don't even know what you're running into. Why would you run into something that's you have no idea what you're running into? So I welcome the argument that this somehow is a better option than staying in the classroom. The pushback I get on that is they're sitting ducks. Mm-hmm. That's the pushback you get. Really? No one shot off a door lock. They're not sitting ducks. And you know what? They figured out Nuvalde because they're waiting there for a freaking hour and a half. They finally broke the windows and pushed out that way because they're waiting so damn long for the cops to show up. And we don't have to get into that because that was a whole, that was not, yes, the media focused on the law enforcement aspect, but that was a disaster from the beginning because of the door lock being broken and other things that happened. But yeah, when it comes down to it, if that classroom is being breached, then that teacher is going to be like, you know what? We're pushing this desk up against the door. I'm taking that filing cabinet and block that door. I'm not going to fight a shooter. I'm not going to have my students fight somebody. I don't have training for that. No way.
So much here that I think people are going to want to unpack. And again, I know you said you can't provide all the training in 45 minutes, let alone on a podcast, right? Nope. And so we're not going to go into all of those details, but we do have a book that we'll talk about in just a minute that people can access and also tell them how they can get in touch with you. But you're raising some interesting questions and some interesting thoughts, and maybe even raising the hair on the back of some people's necks as you're talking and they're thinking through if they're an educator or if they're a parent, how might they respond? Right. And yeah, you hit on some of the things that my mind went to. I immediately started thinking about Uvalde and what happened there. And I know there are some people that would say, well, that needs to be on law enforcement. That wasn't a teacher issue. That was a law enforcement issue. And regardless of fault and blame, there were some lives lost there that should not have been lost for a lot of reasons. What could have and should have happened, I hope we're all learning from that. But part of the evolution of this entire ALICE training is a result of things that happened way back. We can talk Columbine, where we've seen the videos now, where we've seen the camera footage from inside the library, inside the cafeteria, where people were hiding and cowering, but they weren't necessarily in locked rooms. So you're saying don't just go find a place to hide. You're saying go behind a locked door somewhere. So mm-hmm. Let me ask you this, and it's a minor detail. We go into lockdown, everybody locks their door, but kids are in the hallways, kids are in bathrooms, kids are in cafeterias, and now all doors are locked. Where do those kids go? Do we want to teach them to run? Do we teach them to pound on doors? As a teacher, do I open the door for them? Or are those the details that are too specific to talk through on a podcast because we have to look at the logistics of a single school?
Yeah, probably too specific. I know a lot of times we get into what-if situations, Dave.
Yeah.
We can't go into what-if forever. But yes, if something does happen like that, normally what I would tell a teacher, if you have the time, unlock your door, stick your head out in the hallway and grab those students and bring them in as much as possible, then lock your door. The other kids go into the bathroom and just lock themselves in a stall and you know, stand up on the toilet so they can't see your legs. But again, we know the vulnerable areas, auditoriums, band rooms, cafeterias. I mean, lunchtime, that's a disaster. That is, forget it. If you want to have a drill during lunch, it's not going to happen ever because kids have to eat. Legislature says you have to eat. So I tried to get lunchtime drills for the 4 years I was there. You know what? I got one at a high school. That was it. It was only half full at that time. And it was just chaos, which actually worked out because you want chaos. You want stuff going everywhere. And this shooter's like, what the hell? I don't have targets. They're running all over the place, which is fine. But your most vulnerable times, as you know, arrival, dismissal, and lunchtime.
Mm-hmm.
Three most vulnerable times. So, you know, there's no perfect situation. And a lot of times you can't train for those type of situations. Although I tried, because even if you have a gym class outside, I asked the instructor, you hear shooting. You're not coming towards the building, right? He goes, no. I said, where are you going to go? We're going to go to the designated secondary location, which again, every plan should have a secondary location where you're going to meet up later. Yeah, we're going to go across the street or back in the field, wherever somebody's, you know, a church or wherever. So yeah, there's no simple answer to that to say, look, this happened during classroom time, when bell ringing time, when the classrooms were changing. That would be, why would I give somebody the idea, but a shooter could figure that out pretty easy. That would be the most chaotic situation, you know, during those classroom changes, because all these kids are out in the hallway and stuff. But again, and this goes back to, again, the what if situation. For the longest time, I had people say, we're very afraid of the fire, well, pulling the fire alarm, and the shooter's going to be waiting for us outside as we exit out during the fire drill. That lasted for a couple months. I was like, no, sure, everybody came up with some weird situation that's going to happen, but you just can't figure out perfectly every situation. You try to do the best you can. And that's why we go back to the layered situation of making that shooter go through layers of security before they even can get to any kind of victims inside the school. So it's something that's frustrating. It's something that I tried to train in a way that was common sense, that works, that I don't want people to think 10 different things. I want them to think one thing. You keep yourself safe and your students safe and wait for the good guys, because they're coming. And the second thing is, not only keep yourself safe, the second thing is, and again, I don't know if it's an argument about it, but there has been armed school resource officers. Fortunately, Florida legislation passed that they want armed school resource officers in these classes. And that's like the best thing I think they've ever done. And now, you know, I understand the pushback for the defund the police, and the students see, I don't like that uniform. I feel oppressed. This makes me scared to see the guy in the uniform. They're not there to arrest you. They're an advocate. They're an advocate for you, your parents, and the administration. They're there to keep you safe. And every parent you talk to, I would say the majority, love having the school resource officers in those schools. So there's only so much you can do. We don't want to make schools prisons. But I also want teachers to know, to have the confidence, whatever decision is made, it is on them. And I don't want that burden of having two, three, whatever many choices. Get enough stress as it is. You didn't sign up for this. Now you're gonna give you two or three choices whether I should run, fight, stay in the classroom. I don't know. Like I said, I've had incidents where real incidents happen, where I had a school, it was a middle school north of me, not my North County. And it was an individual across the street. He was mad at his mom's boyfriend. So he decided to get a gun. He's going to shoot up the house and probably go in and shoot the boyfriend. Well, what happened was he started spraying, and some of the bullets struck the school across the street. They go into a lockdown, which they should have gone into. Everything turned out fine. The assistant principal, who believed in the safety and security protocols, they were going to go through the lockdown drills. She did an after action event afterwards. She found out one third of her teachers froze. They didn't do anything. And they had gone through drills before. Dave, no one knows how they're going to react in an emergency. I can think I would know how to react because of my training, but you don't know. You don't know how you're going to react. So to tell these teachers, you know, you've got a choice of what to do. Instead of just saying, have the confidence, your door is already locked. You sit down quietly, turn the lights off, close the blinds. Good guys are on their way. You can hear some horrific shit, but they're coming. They're coming. Keep yourself safe. I, for one, I'm in law enforcement. If I didn't have my weapon, I sure as hell am not going to leave that classroom. No way. I'm not going out there. I don't know where the shooter is. I'm not doing it. Don't force me to do it. Don't force me to make that decision. I want to keep myself safe. You think I'm going to bring 25 or 30 kids with me and have that on my mind also? Uh-uh. No, I don't believe in it. I know there's law enforcement out there that believe in it because, oh my God, they're sitting ducks. They're sitting over there all in one corner and somebody's going to come in and kill them all. No, not sitting ducks.
You believe this passionately, obviously, as we can tell just by listening. And you've lived this, right? You, again, have been trained on this. This was your livelihood. You were put in charge of a large, large school system. And 130, 140 schools, 100,000 plus kids. and you've collected data analyzing what you've seen to help articulate this argument that you've made. And then you've taken it a whole nother level where you're not just going on podcasts like mine and sharing this. You put your thoughts, your ideas into a book. Can you talk to us just a little bit about the book so that people can go grab that as well and continue to think through what you're sharing?
Well, a couple of things that personally happened to me directly or indirectly. When Sandy Hook happened, I lived half of my adult life in Monroe, Connecticut, which is the town right next to Newtown. My sister's in Newtown. She lives there now. Her kids went to school there. She was a substitute teacher at this school. Not at that time, because she's, you know, as old as me, but previously she was a substitute at that school. That school and New England itself in that area, the idyllic Currier and Ives New England community. The road is a narrow paved road. You cannot see the school from the road. It's behind a firehouse, hard to get to. So this, it's frustrating because it's not something that, again, where people say, and I've had this happen, never happened here. I don't need to do these drills. It's not going to happen here. So don't ever have the idea that it's never going to happen here. Secondly, so that's close to my home. Secondly, Parkland happened, which I'm down here in Florida. And that happened here when I was still on the job. So after Parkland happened, the legislature decided we don't want civilians in these positions of safety and security anymore. We're going to have the police take over, which I completely disagreed with, because even though I'm law enforcement, police are reactive. They're not proactive. They just don't have the time for that. They don't have the resources or the time for that, or the training, as a matter of fact. So that's the reason I left the job and just became a consultant. So I became a consultant, and, you know, I just started, you know, my own business and figured out, okay, I got to talk to people about this to figure out what the heck's going on. Then Uvalde happened. And that was, again, really upsetting, especially for somebody in law enforcement. That was incredibly upsetting. And my wife at the time said, look, you got to vent. You got to put something out there. So I just started writing. And I wrote this book, and it's called The First 5 Minutes. And the reason it was called that is because, like I said, FBI data has shown that your active shooter, most of the time, not all the time, but the majority of the time, they're going to happen within 3 to 5 minutes. So I called it The First 5 Minutes. In that book, like I said, I have a downloadable screen where you can download the laminated cards. I have in there a generic safety security checklist that you can fill out. And I just mentioned in there, and I wanted to make it a guidebook. I did not want to make it a 200 to 300 page diatribe with every possible scenario that you're going to run into and sit on a shelf and collect dust. It's 77 pages. I swear to God, it'd take you an hour to read. You'll get right through it. I wanted to hit the points where a teacher could flip this open and say, oh yeah, this is what we got to do. Or a principal or a superintendent or a school board saying, this makes sense. We should do that. That's the reason I wrote it. I'm not here to sell books. Books like $12. It's 77 pages. It's a guidebook. I'm not here to sell books. I'm here to sell awareness and promote awareness that, look, lockdowns work. This Alice, this run, hide, fight idea is just an idea that doesn't work. It's not safe. To me, it's dangerous. It's not common sense at all. It works in the corporate world for adults. It was not created for children and students. I don't even care if it's high school students. We did it. When this first came out, I talked to my school's police chief and I said, you know what? Maybe this is a good idea for high school kids because campuses are so large. These kids are adults now, you know, they're adults. They can think for themselves. And we did it. We did it at one of the high schools. We did a run, not a fight thing, but we did a run drill. Worked out okay. Some went this way. We had designated points where they went here and there. But then we sat down and started thinking about it going, where the hell we get to the fight part? What are we going to do there? I mean, when you think about it, you just talk to people in athletics. It takes weeks, months, years for kids to learn athletics, to throw a baseball, a football, put a basketball in the hoop. It takes forever. So I'm going to teach some kid to fight if some shooter gets in there. Parents would have a field day with that. You did what? Even the drill itself is scary. I'm not teach some kid. What's he going to do? Throw something at some shooter, come in there, fight them? What, am I going to train them in some karate or something? No, I got an hour. I got 45 minutes. I got 2 hours maybe to show the teachers. It's impossible. It's not going to work. I understand everybody that gets into these positions, they got to try something new. Guess what, Dave? When I left my position, yeah, we're going to try options-based training. Oh, my God. And I argued with them, and they didn't want to hear anything. I mean, I'm a pariah. No, we're not doing lockdowns anymore. We're going to do options-based training. Even where my son goes to school, I don't have any power in that. I'm going to do front of the school board and sit there for 3 minutes at the lectern going, you shouldn't be doing this because here's the stats that show run, hide, fight doesn't work. So this idea, because it's a knee-jerk thing, it's just like technology. Parents come in and say, we just had a shooting over here last week. 20 kids died. What are you guys doing? Oh, we got a grant from the federal government. You know what? We're going to put in metal detectors. Now we're done. Phew, that's done. Your parents, you're satisfied. We got metal detectors. Everybody's good. Okay, back to class. It's security theater, Dave. It's a knee-jerk reaction that does nothing. If I'm an insane shooter and I'm hell-bent on getting in that school, you think metal detectors are going to stop me? How do you think I'm going to get a weapon in that school in the first place? I know which doors are wedged open. I got a buddy. I can put a backpack in and throw it over the fence. That gun's going to get in there no matter what. You don't think there's athletic events after school? Weekends. Yeah, the door's open. I throw it through a window, whatever. Metal detectors are security theater. It's no, because now you got to train staff. Now you got to worry about maintenance. Now you got to worry about kids getting through the system in time. Yeah, there are some schools that have them, to have them go through. They miss a lot of stuff, just like they miss when you go to the airport. They're not a be-all, end-all. I don't care what these companies say, that they catch everything. They do not. That's nothing but security theater. But that's technology. That's something separate. And that's not what really I want to focus on, although it comes up a lot that, oh, we just need technology. We need cameras. We need door locks. We need a push button on our phone to push a button, locks all the doors, calls the police. We sit back and wait. We're good. Whew. Thank God we got this technology. Well, guess what? I did that also. I had companies coming after me every week. Ambulance chasers. We got the, here it is. Put it on your phone. That's it. Go through. You don't need Wi-Fi. It works on LTE. We have a pilot program. Let's go over here to high school and try it. Guess what? It doesn't work. Hmm. It would fan out. The phone would go in and out. You're trying to get a hold of somebody. I mean, it was just ridiculous going, you're going to depend on this? What if it happens for real? So it's not there yet. Yeah. Is it going to be there in 20, 30 years? Maybe. I don't know what AI is going to be doing. I mean, we've seen already robots going around campus and stuff. You know what? Great. 24 hours a day. They don't have to take a break. They don't need lunch. They don't need all this stuff. That's not the be-all, end-all. Sure, that's a part of it. Everything comes down to humans. It's the human factor. Somebody's got to push that button. Somebody's got to call 911. Somebody's got to call in that lockdown. It's up to the human factor and training and drilling correctly. You know what? When I was in the Secret Service, they would we had to shoot and qualify every single month. We're the only agency that does that every month. Do you know, and you know why they did that? Because they wanted rote, they wanted that muscle memory. Every time you go down there and that target would flape out, I mean, boom, you weren't even thinking. You knew exactly what to do every time. And that's what I try to get with these teachers in this training, to drill enough. Yes, are there arguments to overdrill? Absolutely. Are there ones that, you know, don't drill enough? Yeah, you got to find that fine line where you drill just enough where the teachers and the administration can say, we got it. We got it. Dan, you can come in unannounced. And I had principals that would say that. I want you to come in unannounced and go to that front desk and say, I'm a shooter. You guys got to go into a lockdown. Other principals would be pissed going, you're what? No, we're not doing that. Because as you know, parents would go ballistic. Because a child would go home and they say, how was your day today? Oh, we ran a lockdown drill. Wait, you what? The school never told me that. Oh my God, then it would just go up the ladder. You know, I don't want my child there. It causes anxiety, blah, blah, blah. Look, I went through the Cuban Missile Crisis and we had to go out in the hallway and duck and cover. You think as a kid I gave a crap about that? We were all grab-assing and talking and stuff. The biggest thing was the teachers telling us to shut up and be quiet before we're done with the damn drill. You don't care about that kind of stuff. Just go out and do what you got to do.
You're opening up a lot of Pandora's box here.
I understand, but it's just, look, this is, like I said, I'm passionate about this. I've been through it. The number of drills I've run into basically every situation you can think of. Forgotten keys, kids wandering around. I mean, it's kind of crazy, but the nice thing it was, at least during a drill, you can fix it. That's why I wanted to run as many drills as possible, because You can fix it. Only you can only fix it if you run a drill and you find out what's wrong. I had substitute teachers that, I don't know how to run a drill. What are you talking about? Holy crap. Then I found out when they went through their training of all their 3-day freaking teacher training, they never told them about lockdown drills. Like, what? No, it should be across the board. It doesn't matter what school you're at. Teachers, substitutes, it's all across the board. It's all the same. So the only way you can fix something if you find out something that happens. So the same thing with, you know, lost keys. The other thing I found that it was frustrating, and this is, I know it's a niche area. It's a niche area, but no one has been able to figure it out. I would go to middle school and high schools where they had band rooms and they're playing their music. And you'd walk in there and that crap was loud. I said, how do you guys know when you got a lockdown drill? I said, fire drill is easy. You see the red light going off. I said, how do you know it's a lockdown drill? Like, we don't hear the announcement. I couldn't figure it out. No one to this day has told me how to figure it out because most of these places. I went to a conference. I'm sorry to get off the subject there.
I'm gonna bring you back here in just a second. I'll let you finish up here with this conference.
I went to a conference in North Carolina, okay? And they started talking about social justice and all this other crap, right? So I'm like, okay, let's bring it back around to what's going on with drills, right? So there was a safety and security director for Oakland, California schools, okay? He had the whole school system. And I asked him, I said, how are you doing these drills? And have you run into this issue with loud noises in the cafeteria or band rooms or where they can't hear the announcement? And he looks at me and he goes, Dan, I don't have locks on my door and I don't have cameras. And that's when it dawned on me. Everybody's not the same. I mean, I was fortunate to be in a county where they had enough money and they had the budget and resources to do things. But there are plenty of schools out there that are still back, I'm sorry, in the Stone Ages, where they don't have a budget and they just don't have enough money for even locks on the doors or for just a camera here or there. So that's why I said, look, you have to keep it simple. It's a layered effect. You don't need a lot of money to keep yourself safe.
Well, it's speaking of not needing a lot of money, I think the starting place for everybody right now is $12 on Amazon, right? Buy the book and start to read, or just listen to this podcast and share it with other people, or sit down at a school board meeting and have a conversation, sit down with your neighbor and have a conversation, sit down with your kids and have the conversation. Cause I think you summed it up there at the end that no two schools, no two communities are the same. No two families are the same. Other than we all want our kids to be safe. We want our kids to be secure. We want our kids to live long, prosperous lives. So let's try to figure out the way to do that in the most effective way possible. And it is this overarching, holistic approach where we've got to have people at the grassroots talking about mental health and social emotional learning and all of those things. But it also comes down to making sure the infrastructure is in place and that we can put common sense things in the hands of our teachers to help with our kids. So on that, Dan, how can people get in touch with you if they want to have a conversation with you, or if they want to reach out for your services or have you come in and work with teachers or staff?
The easiest thing is my LinkedIn page. And again, it's the last name, and Dave will put it out there, DLUZNESKI. You find me on LinkedIn. You've got to scroll down a ways, but you'll be able to see the email on there. And you can easily email me if you have any questions. And the book, again, is on Amazon. You put in the first 5 minutes, it'll come up like in the first, 10 titles there or whatever. But yeah, I don't have a Facebook page or anything. I got away from that stuff because social media was just, it's just poison, a lot of social media. So yeah, LinkedIn is the best place to get a hold of me.
You got it. And all those things are going to be noted in the show notes. So make sure you scroll down, click those links if this is something that's important to you, which it should be to all of us. So Dan, thank you so much again for taking time out of your day, sharing your perspective, sharing your experience, sharing your practical wisdom with all of us. I know that you've given me lots to think about, and I guarantee you've given lots to the community to think about.
Thank you, Dave. I appreciate it. Thanks to the audience, and let me have a voice. I appreciate that.
Thank you for checking out this episode of the Lasting Learning Podcast. Your support means the world to me. I would love to continue to connect with you. Feel free to reach out to me at Dave Schmitto on all the things. Connect with me online at schmitto.net or shoot me an email, david.schmitto@gmail.com.